ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ So today's subject is the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna as a spiritual classic. Most of you must have read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, which contains the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna. Now before we enter the topic of the Gospel, it may be very relevant to know something about the man who wrote this book. In fact, that will give us a better view of the work, its relevance, and its practical utility in our everyday life. The author who wrote this work was Mahendranath Gupta. He is known shortly as M. By a sheer coincidence, he happened to meet Sri Ramakrishna when he was a married man with children, running a big family, was a reputed headmaster, a very learned person. He had an advanced degree from the university at that time. And he was well versed in Sanskrit, in English language. He was a specialist in Bible and was a friend of some of the most prominent officers, including the bishop, the heads of the Anglican Church in Calcutta. And in fact, he was also very close to some of the missionaries, European missionaries who used to visit India at that time. So he was a very prominent person, some kind of a celebrity among the elite group of the city. And he was well versed. You know, there was no depth of wisdom. He was not in need of any instruction, any advice. He could himself advise many people. He did advise. He had many students, many people among his students who were quite advanced in different walks of life. But this man had a big problem. He knew all about life because he had read Kalidasa, he had read Shakespeare. So he knew all what really happens in human life. But he was facing a serious dilemma. Running a huge family, and you know, in those days in India, they had this joint family system. Sometimes three generations, four generations, living under the same roof. And maybe the eldest son may be the only breadwinner. And that was his position. He had his wife, his children, and again his cousins living in the same family, in the same home. So a large family. So naturally a lot of conflicts. So one day he decided, that is the tragic part of his life, he decided to put an end to his life. And he walked away from his home at about 10:30 at night. He wandered about in the city. He took a hackney carriage, a horse carriage, traveled for some distance and thought maybe one of his friends will console him and reach there. But the friend was not exactly amused at somebody knocking at his door at midnight. And he was accompanied by his wife also, who became suspicious of the intentions of his husband, who was suffering a lot of turmoil, mental conflicts. So she became very scared. So she also had followed him. So the friend was not exactly in a in a happy mood to welcome him at the midnight. And then he felt the coldness of welcome. He left that home, again wandered about the city. In those days, you know, the city was not so well lighted. And maybe about 2 o'clock or so, he reached his nephew's home. And he stayed there for 2-3 days. After a few days, his nephew, whose name was Siddheshwara Majunda, asked him, "See, there is a holy man sitting in a temple near the Ganges. Seems to be a holy saint. Are you interested? I'm going to meet him. Are you interested? Or you can just go for a walk." In fact, they had really started going for a walk, actually. The nephew suggested meeting this holy man. Sri Ramakrishna was the holy man he was referring to. But actually they were moving from place to place. And in the process, he could also visit the temple and meet the holy man. So both of them happened to reach this Kali temple of Dakshineswar. That was perhaps 1881. And he happened to reach there, and when he reached there, he found Sri Ramakrishna was seated on a cot inside his room, talking to some visitors and his disciples, talking about God, the need to take complete surrender under the feet of the Lord, and all these advices Sri Ramakrishna was giving. He could not fully understand what Sri Ramakrishna was talking about. But somehow this man had already read the great devotional classics of popular Hinduism, like Bhagavata Purana and so on. The Bhagavata Purana had a great saint. His name is Shuka. The whole text is a very famous, the most profound devotional classic in Hindu tradition. It has a strong Advaitic orientation also. It is not purely a kind of emotional work. It is very profound in philosophy and very profound in devotional philosophy and also Advaita philosophy. That's the uniqueness of this book. And I will tell you something about this book. So the book is actually a reply, a response to a question put to a saint by a king. The king happened to commit a terrible sinful deed, and so he was cursed. This is how the mythology goes, that he will die on the 7th day. So he knew he had only 7 days to live. So he left his palace, his kingdom, reached the banks of Ganga, sat there, and he was thinking of God and meditating on God. And then a number of saints and sages happened to come there to see this king who had the wisdom not to cry and weep when he knew he had only 7 days to live, but rather he composed himself. He wanted to prepare his journey in a more intelligent way. And so he happened to come to the banks of Ganga and sit there in meditation. So one of the saints who happened to come at that time to meet him was Shuka. And the king put one question to Shuka. Atha prichami sam siddhim yoginam paramam gurum. That's the meaning. I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to ask you this simple question. Atha prichami sam siddhim yoginam paramam gurum. Purusasyeha yat karyam mriyamanasya sarvatha. What should a dying man do? Or suppose you know you are going to die within a few months, within a few weeks, within a few days. What should you do? In response to this question, the sage gives a long exposition of spiritual life and the great spiritual teachers of ancient times. And this is the Bhagavata classic. So, when Yam saw Sri Ramakrishna seated on his court, talking about God, immediately he writes in the gospel, it flashed in his mind the picture of the great Shuka responding to the question put by the king. The question was, what should a dying man do? So he had read all these classical works. So he get a strong feeling that this is the place that I belong to. This is the kind of conversation that I should listen to. So when you go to a temple or a church or any holy place, you need not be in that same predicament of yam to be able to respond to that situation. You need to be sensitive to spiritual ideas. You need not necessarily have to face a tragic experience. It's not necessary. But a tragedy sometimes will compel you to turn in one direction with the great focus and concentration, and gives you a kind of intensity, a power of focus and concentration. So that was his predicament. So he felt, this is the place I belong to. And he left the place, and his nephew never came back again. We don't hear much about him later. The nephew was the one who accidentally suggested to him, let us go to Dakshineshwar and see the holy man. We don't know if the nephew continued, repeated his visit. Anyway, he doesn't figure as very prominently in any of the gospel literature. But Yam comes back again, and that was the beginning of his spiritual journey. Okay, now I will tell you what some of the great men whom Americans know had to say about Yam. Paramahamsa Yogananda, you must have heard, the author of autobiography. He was staying not far from Yam's home. Paramahamsa Yogananda used to walk along with Yam to Dakshineshwar Kali temple. He writes, silently I had entered his room in awe. The angelic appearance of Master Mahasaya, that is Yam. Yam used to be called Master Mahasaya because he was a well-known headmaster. So with great respect, the public and also his students mostly used to call him Master Mahasaya, the teacher. Silently, I had entered his room in awe. The angelic appearance of Master Mahasaya fairly dazzled me. His silk white beard and large lustrous eyes. He seemed an incarnation of purity. This is what the author of autobiography of Yogi, Paramahamsa Yogananda, had to say about Yam. Now you have a maybe much more powerful, forceful picture from Paul Brunton, who was in a way responsible for popularizing the teachings of Ravana Maharshi and also the teachings of ancient Hindu spiritual traditions, especially in America and Europe during the 30s and 40s. Paul Brunton met Master Mahasaya not long before his passing away. And he has something much more interesting and much more forceful to say. A venerable patriarch has stepped from the pages of the Bible, and a figure from Mosaic times has turned into flesh. So somebody who has read the Old Testament and New Testament, meeting Yam, would feel this man is just straight from the pages of the Old Testament, one of the ancient Hebrew prophets. But he was speaking very politely, very cordially, very smooth, pleasant language. That's the difference. Yam never used an imperative word, language. So, but that respectful, venerable figure, a venerable patriarch, a step from the pages of the Bible, and a figure from Mosaic times, has turned into flesh. That's Paul Brunton. Now, Yam himself had something very interesting to say on how he happened to write the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. So he says, once the master said to me, Yam says, The Divine Mother had told me that you have to do a little work for her. You will have to teach the Bhagavata. Bhagavata symbolically stands for spiritual teachings in the general sense. And he says, to what extent can we foresee God's plan? The Master made me start keeping a diary in 1867 when I was a student of class 8 in higher school. Since then I recorded in my journal my daily activities, the places I had visited, and so on. So what we read today as the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, I mean, if it is Nikhilanandaji's translation, it is an English translation of the original Gospel, which he wrote in Bengali. But there is a, in my opinion, a much more authentic version of the Gospel in English for English reading public. Very short, condensed Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. In a way, it is the original translation in English, more or less in a kind of biblical language by Yam himself. So you find Yam using more or less the same expressions which are found in the King James Version, the first well-known translation of Bible in English. So, and when Vivekananda praised Yam's translation, he was actually referring to Yam's own translation of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. That's what you have to remember. It is very unlikely that Vivekananda never read the Bengali version of the Gospel. That's the popular view. What Vivekananda appreciated was Yam's own translation of his own Bengali. That's a fragment, a fraction of the huge Bengali classic. And that is something very unique. So, that is the history of the Gospel. So he developed this habit of writing diary, which he really, it was a habit that he formed when he was a very small little boy. He was studying in class 8. I met the Master in the later part of February 1882. Not 1881, but 1882. That's when my habit of maintaining a diary really became fruitful. When we look back on our past, we realize that God is making us do everything. When we look back, and when we do not interpret everything in fragments as mere accidental events, but when we try to piece together, when we try to see a connecting thread, then we find there is an unseen, invisible hand, a divine power that is operating behind us. So Sri Ramakrishna explains this in another context in the Gospel. He says, we all believe we should work hard to attain great things. It is necessary. And when we achieve great things, when we look back, then we find even our assertion of our own will, our own freedom, was a manifestation of God's grace. So human effort of free will itself belongs to the jurisdiction, the realm of God's grace. So the example is given, you know, if you want to cross the river, you need a ferry. Right now the boat is anchored and you are sitting on this bank of the river. You have to get up. You have to untie the anchor. And then you have to row from some distance till you reach midstream. Then you will be able to make use of the breeze, the wind that's blowing. And with the help of the wind's direction, you will be able to reach the other bank of the river. So you may perhaps try to analyze the whole thing from a different perspective. Partly it was my effort, the other part was God's grace. But Sri Ramakrishna will tell you that what you wrongly consider to be your own effort or the result of your own effort which has nothing to do with God's grace, were really a fraction of God's grace. But when we reach the other bank of the river and look back, then we understand, well, what I formerly thought was my effort was really God's grace. So that's how Yam thought about it. Yam thought the very idea of writing a diary was actually a manifestation of Sri Ramakrishna's grace. Though he was only a young boy studying at the 8th standard at that time. So when we look back on our own past, we realize that God is making us do everything. God determines beforehand what he will do through a particular person and then gets it done through him. There were many people around the master, but he made me write the chronicle. As a result, the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna came into existence. So even Swami Vivekananda, who was the most prominent disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, once said, now I understand it was given to you. Even Vivekananda could not bring himself to write a biography or write down the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna. He felt when he first glanced on the English translations, Yam's own English translation, then he now understand. And there is, he says that Yam is nowhere to be seen. Only Sri Ramakrishna is visible. So he praised Yam all the more. Very often when we translate, we put ourselves forward and the original man stands behind. You know, as you read books on mindfulness, Buddha is nowhere to be seen. Only the author who read a small little tiny work on mindfulness the other day, he is seen everywhere. Buddha, the original teacher of mindfulness, who taught it 2600 years back, is nowhere to be seen. But Yam was the other way around. Yam is totally invisible. You can't see him anywhere. Only Sri Ramakrishna is visible. So Swami Vivekananda praised him so much. And I would say a few more things. That is Swami Vivekananda's own appreciation of Yam's English translation. Those of you who will enjoy maybe the condensed gospel of Sri Ramakrishna is much more enjoyable as a spiritual work. That's my own personal view. When it comes to English translations, of course the original Bengali is certainly absolutely incomparable. But when it comes to English translation, Yam's own translation may have a more of a spiritual touch because it is closer to Sri Ramakrishna. He is a man who has seen Sri Ramakrishna seeing all these words in front of him. So that's the spiritual feeling you get. So Vivekananda wrote to me about the gospel. Yam says, the move is quite original. Never was the life of a great teacher brought before the public untarnished by the writer's own mind as you are doing. So that's the uniqueness of the book. Now you have to remember, you know how this Vivekananda himself happened to come to Sri Ramakrishna. I mentioned earlier, you know, Vivekananda himself was directed to Sri Ramakrishna by a most unlikely person. He was the well-known professor who had actually made great contribution to European thought. William Hasty, who had some quarrel with the Scottish Church College institution. And he left India later. He went back to England. And he made great contribution by translating Immanuel Kant's classical works into English. That is a unique contribution to European thought. So this William Hasty, English professor, was the one who directed Swami Vivekananda, who was a young student in Scottish Church College, to Sri Ramakrishna. So that's the historical background. And that was a time, you have to remember, the historical, political landscape to understand. You know, Sri Ramakrishna's gospel is essentially a classic on harmony, oneness, unity of humanity and religion. All types of people came to him, people who did not believe in God, They also found something very interesting when they listened to Sri Ramakrishna. And they never went back with empty handed. Agnostics came. Vivekananda himself was an agnostic when he first came to Sri Ramakrishna. He's a Brahma Samaj aspirant. Unbelievers came, great traditional scholars came, conventional believers came. Keshavachandra Sen himself was when some kind of an iconoclast who did not believe in image worship, who did not go to the shrine when he came to the Dakshinesha. Straight away he went to Sri Ramakrishna's room, had a long talk and went back. So this history. Because that was the time when God and religion, as it is today, this is the case today, at a very bad time. You know, God had become very unpopular. Marxism, Marxist humanism, then Darwin's original species, his evolutionary doctrines, and radical humanism, neo-positivism, many of the radical movements had made religion very unpopular among serious thinkers, both in Europe and also in those parts of India where European education had become very, very popular. And again, that was the age of nationalism, you know, border wars, you know. When Sri Ramakrishna was leaving Dakshinesha, you find the Franco-Prussian war took place. And the Romanov emperors in Russia were busy trying to destroy themselves. They were actively working hard to destroy themselves. So, and then Darwin's evolutionary doctrine had already shaken the foundations of some of the dogmatic teachings of Abrahamic religions. And in India, people who had access to modern education had started looking down at their own spiritual heritage. This was the time. So people had openly questioned the concepts of God and religion. Now, how did Sri Ramakrishna talk to them? And of course, in America, civil war had just over. It happened during the time when Sri Ramakrishna was leaving Dakshinesha. So what I mean to say, it was a very critical time. So when people came to Sri Ramakrishna, and the unbelievers, the nihilists, the agnostics, the atheists, and also the traditional conservative Hindus, when they all came to Sri Ramakrishna, he never spoke in the language of negation. You know. His approach was always positive. So you never find Sri Ramakrishna telling anyone, if you don't pray to God or Mother, you will perish. He never says that. He may have asked them to pray to God, but didn't say that if you don't pray to God, everything is going to be destroyed. He never says that. He says, and again, to those who came with complaints, with their own problems, their own domestic problems, M was an example. M was not a believer in the conventional sense of the term when he came to Sri Ramakrishna. He had some arguments with him in the beginning of the gospel, you find. But Sri Ramakrishna's words did not put him off, did not disappoint him. Rather, it made him come back again. He thought there was something more profound that I can learn from this man. So, how to live in this world, in the midst of all these problems, in the midst of all these difficulties, that was the main theme of Sri Ramakrishna in the gospel. You have to remember, the gospel contains teachings which an householder listened to and carefully recorded in his diary. So there is nothing mystical about it in a way. If Sri Ramakrishna had talked about extreme renunciation, if he had praised the ideal of renunciation, mendicancy, taking to sannyasa, those teachings were not heard by Yam, because Sri Ramakrishna reserved those teachings to a few of his disciples who later became monks. That's a very important point to remember. The gospel necessarily doesn't contain teachings exclusively meant for monks. I have frequently heard this complaint from people. Oh, this teaching is all okay. If you are living in a temple without any problem, you can read the gospel. It's wonderful. But the gospel contains teachings meant to help people to live in this world and live in this world more intelligently, to accommodate spiritual values even while confronting problems in secular life. So for example, I can give just quote one simple illustration. There are many. How to live in this world? So Sri Ramakrishna says, for example, you again the imagery of crossing the river in a ferry. He says, the water should not be within the boat. The boat should be on the water. So we can live in this world, but we need not necessarily become worldly minded. So worldly mindedness corresponds to water. So we can live in this world, but that doesn't mean that we should become worldly minded. Worldly mindedness means total rejection of any transcendental, higher ethical, moral values, extreme pragmatism, judging everything by the yardstick, by the criterion of to what extent that brings us some practical benefit. In other words, in modern language, judging everything by the few dollars that you may get right now. So, going beyond that, we can accommodate some spiritual values. So, then he gives the example, worldly mindedness is water, life is this river, and we are our own life is the boat, and this the process of living in this world is like river. So water or worldly mindedness should not enter the boat. The boat should remain on the surface of the water. Another example, for example, he says, in the tropical countries, you know, they have a peculiar fruit which we don't have maybe in this country, jackfruit. So it is full of sticky milk. So if you cut it, the sticky milk will smear your hands. Your hands will become dirty, difficult to wash it off. So, but then if you just rub your hands with oil and then cut the jackfruit, then the sticky milk will not smear the hands. So what is the oil here? Faith in God. In Vedantic terms, the idea that all these things will come and go. We have to live in the world. We have to interact with things in this world. We have to face the reality of worldly life. But we should also remember all these things are impermanent. They are transitory. They are not everlasting. Once this wisdom, if we keep in our mind, then we won't be so much obsessed with these worldly pleasures. I mean, we won't be spiritually enslaved by what the senses bring to the mind. We will be able to dictate the senses. The senses will not dictate to us. So this is what is called, rubbing the hands with oil. These simple examples you find in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Again, harmony of religion, for example, Sri Ramakrishna says, there are very, very profound ideas I've put in simple parables and examples. Water that you drink for quenching your thirst. The effect of quenching the thirst by drinking water is not dependent upon the name by which you call the water. Whatever name you may call, if you drink it, your thirst will be quenched. But you may call it by different names. Like that, God can be called by different names, or spiritual ideas can be called by different names. It doesn't matter what name you call it. Once we practice it, it will benefit us. So there are such examples which are very, very simple examples that you find in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. So, one example I can give. See, Sri Ramakrishna says, for example, that many of us want to live a spiritual life. He gives the example of a great dramatist, a very prominent writer of contemporary Bengal called Girishchandra Ghosh, who was a genius who had made some unique contribution to Bengali theatre. But he was also a profligate, who was drunkard, who had a very loose life. But this man had one good quality. He had faith. So whatever he thought or said he will do, that he will do, or he will do his best to do what he says he will do. So this man happened to come to Sri Ramakrishna. I'm not going to those details. So he wanted some instruction. Now Sri Ramakrishna knew he was a chronic drunkard who can't live without alcoholic drinks. If Sri Ramakrishna told him, don't drink tomorrow onwards, he will not take that teaching very seriously, because it is actually impossible for him. So what Sri Ramakrishna told him, well, you think of God at least when you get up in the morning or when you go to sleep in the evening, at night. And he was a sincere man. He said, well, I cannot give my promise because I don't know when I get up in the morning, because mostly drunk. And where he is going to go to sleep or where he is going to get up himself, did know. And he was a sincere person. That sincerity helped him for eventually becoming a saint. He became eventually a great saintly person. So he said, I can't practice it. Then Sri Ramakrishna told him, you do once, you take the name of God. That also he can't do. Then Sri Ramakrishna told him, you give the whole responsibility, the power of attorney in legal language, to me. He said he thought it was a very simple thing to do. And he did, all right, I give my responsibility. He thought he can give the responsibility to Sri Ramakrishna, then he can have a jolly life, bohemian life as he was leading. But what happened was, once he said, I'm giving you my power of attorney, it became psychologically impossible for him to do anything evil. It became impossible for him to say or do anything evil. Eventually, the thought of doing something undesirable, he was leading a very, very loose life, a bohemian life. So whenever the thought of doing something unpleasant or undesirable occurred in his mind, another thought came and blocked it. So he had to stop drinking once for all. So gradually you find a transformation happening in his life. Why? In spite of all other problems, he had one good quality. He was a sincere, a transparent person. So he's an example of this type of people. People with extreme faculties, genius you may say. Great artists, poets, philosophers, mystics. Not mystics in this sense. I'm talking about those who write, draw poems, draw pictures and write poems, write great novels, short stories, musicians. But not able to live a very disciplined life in the private life. So there is an interesting verse in the ancient Hindu mythological works, It says, Yappuman atimedhavi chadurnam ekamasnudi atpayu anapatyova daridra padidopiva. It's very interesting. It looks very strange, but it's a fact. Any person who drives hard to accomplish something very great, very profound, very outstanding in life, say a great musician, a great artist, a great poet, without a spiritual element in his character, that person will have one serious drawback. So the verse tells you, he will be either short-lived or he may have a serious, terrible deviation, as it was the case with Girish Chandra Ghosh, a genius who had accomplished superhuman things in Bengali theatre, but he was a loose character, he was a bohemian. And he became a great person when he came in contact with Sri Ramakrishna. Because as I mentioned, anyone who drives hard through their own intellectual powers, puts their own faculties and mind in a state of imbalance, and that creates a kind of psychological lopsidedness. And that could manifest in the form of profligacy, alcoholism, or even poverty. Such people will not care for their own existence, worldly existence. So they become extremely lopsided. This is an essential drawback to people, to anyone who works hard to achieve something very great without a spiritual element. That's an important thing. This drawback can be completely avoided, averted, by bringing into our life a spiritual ideal. The spiritual ideal will protect us from facing any of these drawbacks. So this Girish Chandra Ghosh is one great example in this. Again, there are certain people in whose life a problem becomes an indirectly a blessing. That's again what happened to some of the characters in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. A woman devotee who had lost her children was a widow, or a man like Yam, who in spite of all his great achievements, all his accomplishments, and leading a pure life, was faced with this very serious problem in his domestic life. There was no peace in his family. Now, very often, this unpleasant situation can become an indirect blessing. That's again, there is a sloka. Yasya anugraham icchami tasya vittam haramyaham bandhavaisya viyogena brusham bhavati dukkhitaha tena dukkhena samtaptu yadimam na parityaje tam prasadam karishyami ye devairabhi sudurlabham. This verse is again from another devotional classic. What it means is this. If God wants to bless you, if God has a special consideration for you, so to speak, if you are in his good books, so to speak, then he will give you some pinpricks, some little problems, so that you be reminded of something higher, something beyond worldly enjoyments. So if any of his devotees get obsessed or get lost by their extreme attachment to any worldly ambitions, then in order to make them turn towards God, God gives some problems for them. So the verse, this particular verse in metaphoric language says, I will take away all their wealth so that they will become pauper, so that they will be forced to turn to me, and then that become an opportunity for him to get spiritually elevated. You may not like such a God who forces you to turn to himself through problems. But the verse contains an interesting meaning. If you look at the lives of great mystics, if you look at the life of great spiritual personalities, in very many cases, it was what we normally consider as problems, which they do not consider as problems, which compelled them to turn to higher spiritual aspirations. That's the story. And again, in the Gospel, there are some very interesting teachings. In a very humorous way, Sri Ramakrishna says, for example, desire. All of us have desire. We all have ego. So, before we pray to God for something, we must learn how to pray and what to pray for. This idea is put in a very humorous language, you know. So in the gospel you see, there is one man, he was traveling maybe in the forest, and he sat under a tree, and that tree was a kalpavriksha. It is again a mythological concept. A tree which will give you whatever you need, whatever you happen to have a desire for in your mind. When you are sitting under that tree, if you have any desire, that tree will immediately fulfill that desire. That's a mythological concept. So this concept is taken to illustrate the natural aspirations of human beings in the gospel you find. So one man happened to sit under a tree which was actually kalpavriksha, a wish-fulfilling tree. That's how they translate it. So he was very hungry, and he was very tired. So if I only had a wonderful place to sit comfortably, the thought came to him immediately, a big sofa appeared before him. Then he said he wanted to sit and rest more comfortably. If only I can have a little good sleep, then a bed, a beautiful bed appeared before him. So he wanted many things. Then he wanted a lot of food, good food. Immediately all food appeared before him. So before any thought was just about to flash in his mind, that became a reality. He had it. Then after some time he thought, well, now he was quite comfortable. He had a wonderful lunch and he was lying comfortably in a pleasant bed. Now this forest is full of tigers. If the tigers happen to come, maybe with serious danger. The thought came, a tiger came and killed him and ate him. That story goes. Now the point is, before we turn to God, before we turn to focus on something, we should know what to look for, what to desire for. This is only an illustration. But what Sri Ramakrishna says is, we should not pray for worldly achievements to God. That's the point. If you pray for worldly achievements, that itself can eventually become a problem. But remember, this is a problem only if we do not have faith in God. If you have sincere faith in God, then even if you pray for undesirable things, if you aspire for undesirable things, they will not happen. Rather, God will put wisdom in our mind and will teach us how to look for higher things. So you find many such great teachings in the gospel. In another context, I can read from the gospel itself, then I shall explain. There was one man, Mr. Vishwas. He had a very luxurious life. When he squandered all his money, he led a very loose life. There's an interesting episode I'm reading. Then I shall try to expound a very profound teaching from the gospel. Mr. Vishwas had been sitting in the room a long time, the name of a devotee. He now left. He had once been a wealthy man, but had squandered all his money in an immoral life. Finally, he had become indifferent to his wife and children. Referring to this gentleman, Vishwas, Sri Ramakrishna said, "He's an unfortunate wretch. An householder has his duties to discharge, his debts to pay, his debt to gods, his debt to his ancestors, the rishis, the wife and children, relations. He should look after them." Then another devotee said, "Mr. Vishwas now wants to cultivate the company of holy persons." Sri Ramakrishna, that's an interesting thing. Sri Ramakrishna says, "A monk's commentary goes to the four principal holy places with him, but he still tastes bitter." You know, commentary, which is a kind of water pot used by monks, wandering monks, it is made of some kind of a wood timber, which is very bitter. So that's what it is talking about. So a monk's commentary is about that particular water pot. it still tastes bitter. It may travel with the monk to all the holy places on pilgrimages, but doesn't have any effect. It still tastes bitter. Likewise, it is said that the Malaya breeze turns all trees into sandalwood, but there are very few exceptions, such as the cotton tree, Ashwatha, and Hopla. Some frequent the company of holy persons in order to smoke hemp. Many monks, so there's a, I mean, they may, in those days, you know, they used to have this, to face cold winter, they used to smoke in the Himalayan regions. So the point is, what Sri Ramakrishna says is, the case of this devotee, there's a natural inclination in the mind of many people for something evil, even when they know it is not good for them. That's a very profound psychological, from a psychological perspective, very profound teaching from the gospel. You can see that. So Sri Ramakrishna gives a very interesting parable, a camel. You know, camel, it goes about in a desert and then it eats some thorny bush. The more it eats those leaves, it starts bleeding. Its mouth starts bleeding because it's full of thorns. But the camel has still no problem. It enjoys the blood without knowing that it is hurting its own mouth, its own tongue. And the more it bleeds, the more thorny leaves it wants to eat. So there's a natural inclination among some persons, a distaste, an indifference, a lack of interest in spiritual matters. Sri Ramakrishna gives another example. He says, give the example of a fish vendor. A fish vendor took shelter in the house of a gardener, flower gardener. So at night, this fish vendor was given a room to sleep, but unfortunately for her, the room was full of beautiful, sweet-smelling flowers. So this fish vendor could not sleep. It was so terrible for her. So she started complaining, "Oh, this terrible smell full of flowers, I can't sleep." Then the good hostess brought her own fish basket, which is foul-smelling fish basket. Then she had a wonderful sleep. And he sprinkled some water. So this fish basket started with a very foul smell and she had a wonderful time. So there is a natural tendency among certain people for evil, even if they know it. Sri Ramakrishna says we must try to keep a long distance from them. So the old Vedantic idea of using four approaches in dealing with different people in the world occurs in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Many of the great teachings of the Vedic literature and other devotional literature can be found in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Many great teachings which are expounded in profound Sanskrit language are put in simple language in the Gospel. So, you know, it is said in the Bhagavata Purana, there is an interesting suggestion as to how to live in this world. So, Ishwareta dadhineshu barisheshu dushasuja prema maitri kripa ubeksha yakkarobi samadhyamaka. That means, the people whom you interact with in our everyday life belong to these four categories. There are people who are spiritually more exalted than us. And then there are those who may be, we want to know about higher things, but may not know. Then there are those who are our equals. There are those who may pour cold water on your own convictions. People who bring skepticism and doubt into our mind. So Sri Ramakrishna says, we must keep a long distance from people who distribute skepticism and doubt, because they have an inherent taste for the negative. Not that they are lost once for all, not at all. Gradually they also will evolve. For beginners in spiritual life should be careful when they associate with them. So you find many of these great teachings, but I'm going to take just a few interesting teachings from the gospel, then I shall conclude. Here Sri Ramakrishna is a very profound philosophy of religious harmony. We should remember Swami Vivekananda's teachings in modern times are nothing but the great Vedanta teachings put in the language of Sri Ramakrishna. So for example, the idea of universal religion, religious harmony, which Vivekananda preached and which Swami Trinadidananda symbolized by constructing the altar temple. All these ideas are originally coming from the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. I mean, they are coming from Sri Ramakrishna, but all these teachings can be found in the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. So there is an interesting part from the gospel. It's an old work, the sayings of Sri Ramakrishna, published in the beginning of the 20th century. Two persons were hotly disputing as to the color of a chameleon. So the story is this. A man found a chameleon under a tree and it was brown in color. And then he left. After some time, another person came. Then it was dark. Then the third person came. Then it was a different color. So they were disputing, asserting that the color that they saw is the original color of the animal. So that's a story. Two persons were hotly disputing as to the color of a chameleon. One said, "The chameleon on that palm tree is of a beautiful red color." The other, contradicting him, said, "You are mistaken. It is red. It is not red but blue." Not being able to settle the matter by arguments, both went to the person who always lived under the tree and had seen and watched the same animal in all its phases of color. One of them said, "Sir, is it not the chameleon? Is the chameleon is red?" "No," he said, "it is neither red exclusively or blue exclusively." He said, "It has got all these colors. The color depends upon the time and the person who sees that." Like that, God or religion or spiritual ideals, they essentially are the same. The same idea may be called by different names, defined in a different way in one tradition, understood and interpreted differently in another tradition, but the reality is one and the same. That's what Sri Ramakrishna says. Now, this concept is the basis of Vivekananda's first Chicago address. Swamiji quotes from Shiva Mahimna Stotra and Bhagavad Gita and so on. But the idea, this profound idea of religious harmony, interreligious harmony, originally came from the Vedanta teachings, but they were put in modern language for the first time by Sri Ramakrishna. Again, many people have wrong ideas about image worship. Vivekananda tries to explain this on his paper on Hinduism and innumerable other lectures. Sri Ramakrishna puts it in a very simple language. So Swamiji must have heard this from other sources. We should remember that Vivekananda was not always present when these teachings happened. But in many of these instructions, Swami Vivekananda was present. The point is, all these teachings were given in the presence of Yam, who was always present. And very often, other monastic disciples of Sri Ramakrishna, like Vivekananda, were also present on many of these occasions. So, as a as a toy fruit or a toy elephant reminds me of the real fruit and a living animal, so do the images of worship, images worshipped remind me of one God who is formless and eternal. Now this is simple too. When you worship an image or a photo or any symbol, you are not worshipping the symbol as it. The symbol is taken only as a representative of a higher ideal which transcends symbolism. So this is the basic principle behind image worship. That's what Sri Ramakrishna says. He says, image worship reminds you of the formless. So apparently there's a contradiction. You can find this criticism. Image worship is just the opposite of Advaita, or it contradicts religious traditions which do not apparently believe in images. But truth is, an image or a symbol is a help for us to focus our mind on. When you sit somewhere and think of God, the first thing you have to do is to bring your mind away, to withdraw your mind away from the empirical objects of this world, because the mind is always being dragged by the eyes, by the ears, by the sense of smell, sense of touch, sense of taste, all these five senses of perception drag the mind to innumerable objects around the world, everywhere. 8 billion people all the time are creating their own external world of senses when their minds are being drawn towards various objects. Now, how do you think of something that you cannot see or hear or taste or smell? So you have to think of something beyond that. For that you need a symbol. You have to withdraw your mind away from, or your senses away from these objects. For withdrawing, you need a counter focus. You have to withdraw your mind and senses away from external things towards something which is internal. For that, you need an external visible symbol which represents the higher transcendental formless reality which is beyond symbolism. So every image worship is only a tool, a means to transcend images. Every external worship is a method, a means, it is a path towards transcending and reaching the formless. This is the philosophy and symbology of image worship. This is what Sri Ramakrishna puts in very simple language. He says, when you worship an image made of clay, you are not meditating on the clay. You are meditating on the higher symbol which that entity represents. So if you are seeing before you a crucified form of Jesus, you are not actually talking about death or crucifixion or terrible pain. You are actually thinking of higher spiritual ideal which Jesus symbolizes, the deathless, the immortal, the universal, the eternal spiritual ideal that Jesus symbolizes. So that is true of image worship also. So these ideas put in very simple language by Sri Ramakrishna. If a man thinks of the images of gods and goddesses as symbols of the divine, he reaches divinity. Only symbols. Images are not gods. Images are only symbols of God. And symbols are necessary because we need a counter focus for our mind to concentrate on. When we try to withdraw our mind away from the external world of sensual objects, we can do that only by diverting our mind to something internal. But before diverting our mind to the internal, you need in front of you a higher beautiful symbol. The symbol can be a great book, it can be a great teaching, it can be a great statement, it can also be a visible symbol. That's what Sri Ramakrishna is talking about. So in fact these ideas were put forward in a graphic language of Vivekananda in his innumerable lectures. But they all came from Sri Ramakrishna. But if he considers them as mere idols made of stone, straw and clay, to him the worship of those images will produce no good. So every image worship is a way, a method, a means towards transcending image worship. So that's what Sri Ramakrishna says. The master said, everything that exists is God. So, but before we realize this, we need to practice. For this practice, we need some higher teachings, prayers, meditation, external worship. For this, we need symbols and images. So, I'm concluding my talk. Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna is a unique work. It doesn't belong to any particular religious tradition. You find in that gospel a very, very universal spiritual idea. And among those who read today, there are people who don't even believe in God. In fact, one of the greatest tributes to the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna came from Gandhi himself. He said, seeing the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna will give the experience of seeing God face to face. That is his own thing. So when you read the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you can see the God is not just a concept, it's not an idea, it's not a doctrine, it is not something or somebody sitting somewhere invisible, watching us. No. You get a most sublime ideal of the God concept, whatever tradition we may belong to. Even when we do not belong to any tradition, the ideal, the concept of some universal higher spiritual reality. That's what the gospel teaches about. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.